They called him a community don, but the truth was darker than any title could hide. Lester Lloyd Cook, known to the world as Jim Brown, wasn't just a gang leader. He was the hand of death in Tivoli Gardens, the man who enforced loyalty to Jamaica's ruling party with bullets and blood, backed by the powerful Jamaica Labour Party during a time when politics was war. Jim Brown didn't just kill for power. He built an empire from it. Guns in, drugs out, bodies buried in the name of democracy. But when the U.S. government finally caught up with him and demanded his extradition, everything started to unravel. And just before the day he was supposed to board that plane to Miami, he burned alive in his cell, locked from the outside. No one was ever charged. No investigation dared go far. This wasn't just a gang story. This was a state secret wrapped in silence, where the fire didn't just kill a man, it protected a system. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Don who never ran Tivoli Gardens didn't just breathe politics, it bled it. In the 1970s and 1980s, West Kingston had become the blood-soaked front line of Jamaica's political war. On one side, the People's National Party, PNP, armed with socialist vision and grassroots fury. On the other, the Jamaica Labour Party, JLP, backed by American dollars, Cold War paranoia, and men like Edward Seeger. And then, there was Jim Brown, Lester Lloyd Cook, born in the trenches of poverty and sharpened by the brutal codes of the street, was not your average criminal. He was calculated, charismatic, cunning. While other gangsters played dice in back alleys, Jim Brown sat in meetings with political elites, wearing silk shirts and gold rings, talking strategy over scotch. By the late 1970s, the JLP needed muscle, and Jim Brown became its spine. His turf, Tivoli Gardens, turned into a fortress. Opposition party members dared not campaign there. Gunmen patrolled rooftops, and every election season brought bloodshed. The message was simple: vote JLP or disappear. In exchange, Jim Brown received what every criminal craves most: impunity. Police avoided Tivoli unless they wanted a war. Guns flowed in through secret channels. Some say through the Jamaican Defense Force itself. Cocaine shipments moved smoothly from Colombia to Kingston to Miami. The shower posse, so named for the way bullets rained down on their enemies, spread across the diaspora from New York to Toronto. And Jim Brown stood at its center like a king surrounded by loyal killers. But this wasn't just gang warfare. This was state-sanctioned terror. Jim Brown's enemies didn't just include rival dons. They included political opponents. PNP supporters disappeared. Opposition voices were silenced. Human rights groups begged for international attention. But few dared cross Seeger, who held power from 1980 to 1989, and who saw Jim Brown as essential to maintaining his rule. In 1980 alone, over 800 Jamaicans were murdered in politically charged violence, the deadliest election year in the island's history, and Jim Brown was the butcher behind many of those numbers. But violence alone doesn't build an empire. Jim Brown understood community optics. He handed out school books, paid rent, buried the dead. On Sundays, he wore white suits to church and shook hands with the elders. Mothers in Tivoli called him Father Jim. Their children feared and worshipped him. And the politicians, they smiled and posed with him in public until the Americans came knocking. By the late 1980s, U.S. federal agencies had been tracking the shower posse's movements through Miami, Brooklyn, and Atlanta. Wiretaps, witness testimonies, and drug busts all pointed to the same thing: a violent narco-political empire headquartered in Tivoli Gardens. At the top of every chart, Jim Brown. In 1990, a U.S. federal grand jury indicted him on multiple charges, including drug trafficking, racketeering, and murder. Washington demanded extradition, but Jamaica's justice system, corrupt, slow, and politically entangled, dragged its feet. For 2 years, Jim Brown remained untouchable, hiding in plain sight, moving through Kingston like a ghost in daylight, until 1992, when the pressure became too loud, even for the JLP. He was finally arrested, but few believed the state would ever let him talk. Then came the fire. Chapter 2, The Cell That Burned Itself, February 23rd, 1992. The day Jim Brown was supposed to be extradited to the United States. He had spent the previous week at the General Penitentiary in Kingston under heavy security, or so they said. His cell was reportedly locked from the outside. Guards had strict instructions. No visitors, no communication, no mistakes. At 1 a.m., smoke began pouring from Block C. By the time fire trucks arrived, it was too late. The blaze had already torn through Jim Brown's cell. His body was found curled up near the door, blackened beyond recognition. The most dangerous man in Jamaica had burned alive. The official story, electrical fire, but no one believed that, not even the state. There were no scorch marks outside his cell, no electrical wiring anywhere near the supposed ignition point. And oddly, none of the other inmates were harmed, just him. Only him. Inside the prison, whispers turned to screams. Guards spoke of strange orders the night before. Cameras turned off. Logs erased. Evidence vanished. One said they were told to step away from Block C. Another swore he saw men in civilian clothing walking through the prison yard just hours before the fire. Outside, the streets of West Kingston exploded. Some mourned. Some celebrated. Most simply waited for the truth that never came. Jim Brown had taken secrets to the grave. Secrets about drug routes, about payoffs, about the true alliance between Jamaican politics and transnational crime. And now, conveniently, he would never testify, never face a courtroom, never answer to anyone. His funeral was massive. Politicians stayed away, but thousands poured into Tivoli to say goodbye. Wailers sang hymns, dancers stomped the dirt, gunshots rang in the distance, half tribute, half warning. His coffin was gold-trimmed. The air was thick with sweat, sorrow, and unfinished business. In the aftermath, the U.S. demanded answers. The Jamaican government launched an inquiry, but like all things in the island's political theater, it was all smoke and mirrors. The report blamed a faulty electric socket. No arrests were made. No one was held accountable. And the political machine moved on. But the fire had consequences. The vacuum left by Jim Brown was filled by his son, Christopher Dudas Koch, trained in secrecy, armed with legacy. Dudas would take the shower posse to new heights, maintaining his father's brutal hold over Tivoli until 2010. When his own extradition would spark another violent reckoning. The cycle repeated itself. Blood for votes, guns for power, silence for survival. To this day, many Jamaicans believe Jim Brown was silenced, not to protect the criminal underworld, but to protect the political elite. That his death wasn't an accident, but a message. No one talks, not even kings. And while Jamaica paints murals of Bob Marley and Usain Bolt, there's another kind of legacy buried under the ash. The legacy of a Don who became more powerful dead than alive.